cannot sit somewhere around the wall in your air conditioned office and design a project, and you expect me to copy it and paste on the field as if I were a robot.
Welcome to the Problem with Partnerships, a Building Peace podcast series from Peace Direct. I'm Ravel Singh Baines, your host for this series, exploring how to decolonize the system of international cooperation. That's the humanitarian, development, and peacebuilding sector. We're focusing on decolonizing the partnerships between local activists and international NGOs and funders in the sector. To build better partnerships, we must address the problems holding us back: systemic racism, white supremacy, and racialized power imbalances. At Peace Direct, we believe local people are the experts in the conflicts that affect their communities, and only they understand what it takes to build peace that lasts. We believe peace initiatives should be designed and owned by these local experts, and that they should have the freedom to adapt these initiatives to the changing needs of the community that they work in. Our sector is slowly coming around to this idea, but there are many organisations that still don't respect local expertise or trust local experts to lead. Last year, we launched our guide to transforming partnerships in international cooperation. It's a tool for our sector to use to understand the problems undermining our partnerships and to find concrete pathways towards more equitable and transformative relationships. The guide wasn't based on our beliefs. It was based on several consultations with hundreds of people who shared their lived experiences of working in this sector. Those local experts highlighted that they are often treated as contractors or service providers, implementing short-term projects on behalf of international NGOs who don't know the community's unique needs. They are not respected or trusted. Their expertise is not valued. Participants also identified that trust is one of the four key values absolutely essential for an equitable and decolonized partnership.
When we talk about trust, we are also talking about issues of mutual respect. When you don't trust me, it means you don't respect my capacity as a local expert.
This is Nicolene Nwenushi Waze, a gender and development specialist, jurist, human rights defender, and civil society activist in Cameroon. She is also the CEO and founder of Pathways for Women's Empowerment and Development.
I have the mastery. I am a local expert, and I always tell my partner, I am a local expert. I go to the field. I know what is happening there. This thing is happening within a community where I was born and brought up in. I know exactly how the paradigms in this community have been shifted by the ongoing crisis. Like, I am coordinating a project that was audited last week, and the auditor was asking us things like the hall that we used was too expensive. But this is what actually happened. We go down to the field, the Anglophone crisis is fully ongoing, and we go down to the field to carry out a project on the localization of the women, peace and security, and the empowerment of women and youth. And to penetrate this community, we need first and foremost to hold a pre-advocacy meeting with the administrative authority. That is not in the budget, but this is the only way that we can enter this community. You cannot enter this community without first meeting the administrative authority. And we come to the administrative authority, and the administrative authority suggests that we launch the project so that the traditional authorities and all the administrative authorities in this sub-region are aware of our presence in this community. That is for our security and in line with the humanitarian principle of do no harm. And we communicate this to the partners that this is the process. We launch the project, and for the launch of the project, the administrative authority is clear. They use only one hall, which is the council hall, for their security, because all the administrative arsenal, the defense and security offices, all of them, they are the same in this same vicinity for their security purposes. So they use only the council hall. The council hall is a hall of about 250 to 300 capacity, right? And it has a unique price. But if you are using it to hold an event for 60 people because of security issues, you have to pay the price. You have to pay the entire price of the console hall. They have only one sound system person that penetrates that their secured space, because any person coming out from that space with a sound system could just be carrying an explosive. This is their protection mechanism. Mm-hmm. You don't want us to defile this protection mechanism because the donor or the international organization has written on the project document what we have to do. This is just a tip of an iceberg of the project that I coordinated that was audited last week. We were supposed to just copy and paste all that was written on the project. So when I look at this, I see the partnership as not being equitable for this project. The 20th May celebration in Cameroon has become very, very controversial with the ongoing crisis. And we went for this project in April. The administrative, everybody wants to draw the blanket to themselves, right? The administrative authority was trying to use this launch of the project to launch their 20th May activities. And if we did not have a mastery of this controversy and allow them to do this, we will never even put our foot in that community again, because the non-state armed groups will take us for propagandas for government. So all of these things, we need to be able to navigate all of these things. And when we succeed to navigate all of these things and we come out successfully and safe, we expect our partners to be happy for us. They shouldn't be castigating us. They shouldn't be suspecting us. They shouldn't be treating us with contempt and the type of disdain that some treat us with. So these are my recommendations. Please, mutual respect. Yeah. Consider that, know that we are grassroots experts and we have a mastery of the situation on the ground and the capacity to navigate this situation and be neutral and impartial and keep safe. And when we go to the field, we need to be flexible in order to be able to achieve the goals of the project. You think about your money and your visibility. You don't think about our safety. You don't think about the safety of the people that we are going to meet. These people, grassroots people, they have been through a lot. They don't even want people to come and propose anything to them, because things that have been wrongly proposed to them have led them to more harm than alleviated the harm that the sufferings that they are facing.
What Nicolene has raised here is so demonstrative of the problems we've heard other local experts have experienced, that there is a lack of trust towards local actors and a lack of respect for local expertise, for the context and for the community as a whole. This lack of trust is rooted in white supremacy and systemic racism, a belief that people in the countries like the US and UK are superior and no better than those in countries like Cameroon or India. It's one thing not to trust your colleagues. It's another to not trust them while holding disproportionate power over them. International funders and NGOs wield the most power in these partnerships, and this power imbalance has practical implications.
So, these partnerships need to be equitable. They need to give due consideration to the local context, especially when they are happening within a context of a conflict like what we are facing in Cameroon. Please listen to us on the field. We are the experts. We know what is happening on the field, and we just want this thing to succeed for all of us. But for it to succeed, we shouldn't sacrifice the lives of our people who are supposed to be the beneficiaries. Some international NGOs, the one that as they sit in their offices somewhere around the world and write those projects, we should robotically copy them and paste on the ground without contextualizing them, without taking into consideration what are the needs and of the people on the ground. Mm. I'm talking here about flexibility. Some of them are very, very allergic to flexibility. Mm. When they say the project should be 1, 2, 3, it should be 1, 2, 3, there is like you don't have any right to adjust from those projects. And at the end of the day, they don't reflect our realities on the ground, they don't meet the needs of the purported beneficiaries of this project. You cannot sit somewhere around the world in your air-conditioned office and design a project, and you expect me to copy it and paste on the field within a conflict context as if I were a robot. Recently, when we went down for one activity, the community people, they want to live together. They want community cohesion. Community cohesion is the strength of this community. And we asked them some of the things that they thought they could do for them to live together, for this community cohesion, because if there is cohesion in the community, they think they can maintain peace and fight against this violent extremism, for instance. They gave us their ideas. We don't always go there to ask, to assess what are their needs. They have assets. Even their knowledge is their assets. And then you should allow us to be able to be flexible when we go down to the communities and they propose what they think is a priority for them. Let's agree and shift the paradigms to meet their priority so that what we are doing can have impact. It must not always be about our visibility, because this is what most of these international community, international NGOs are interested in. They're interested in their visibility. What about impact? So yeah, I'm raising the issue of flexibility. What I am trying to say that respect should be at the core of any human relationship. We are partners. They are our technical partners. We just say, let there be mutual respect in the work that we are doing. Let there be flexibility. Let there be trust. Mm-hmm. I think they are just the same recommendations that we are making over and over and over again, facing the same challenges in different contexts and making the same recommendation. There needs to be an alignment of the understanding of the international NGO and the understanding of the grassroots NGO. We need to give due consideration to the expertise of those working on the field. We need to know that we cannot copy and paste project activities without contextualizing or tailoring them to mm-hmm. the reality on the ground at the time of the implementation of the project. And we need to know that local actors have a mastery of what is happening on the ground.
As Nicolene pointed out, international NGOs and funders undermine the impact of their shared work by failing to trust their local partners. Participants in our Transforming Partnerships consultation identified additional ways in which their international partners either granted or withheld trust and respect. Funding emerged as a critical aspect. It's the most visible and contentious part of partnerships. Inflexible funding programs limit the role of local actors, preventing meaningful partnerships, and can force Global South civil society to quote-unquote professionalize to Western standards, creating inherently unequal and colonial power dynamics that reinforce white supremacy.
At the end of the day, this thing is a give and take. It is not charity. Nobody mm-hmm. is doing charity for the other. Because when the international organizations write these projects, they have salaries for their staff. Their salaries mm-hmm. come from this project that they write. But when they subcontract this project to us, they don't know that we work in offices. They think that we stand on the streets and work. They don't even pay us partial rent for the offices. And when we look for where to remove a partial rent for the office, we are questioned on that. They don't buy equipment for our office. Normally, when we are implementing a project for an organization, that organization should provide us with equipment for that project. If we're implementing a localization project with an organization for 3 years, there should be able to be a desktop specifically in the office for that project and some other document and some other instrument. You don't expect us to carry a project and put it in our old desktop, and then when the desktop crashes tomorrow, you are asking us documents. What did you provide us with to save the documents inside? You did not provide us with an instrument to save the documents inside. These are some of the things that we are really, it is a give and take. It is mm-hmm. no charity. people should understand that they are not doing any charity by working with us. It is a win-win situation for both of us. Because if we are not on the ground to implement those projects, funders will not fund them, knowing that they cannot go on the ground and implement the project. They are using us, they are leveraging on our local expertise to build those projects. And we want to be respected for that. Partnerships cannot be equitable if we don't take all of these factors that we have just mentioned. If we don't trust one another, we don't mutually respect one another, we are not flexible in the work that we are doing. If we go to the work that we are doing, like some robots that we only according to the commands of the machine, the partnership cannot be equitable because I'm working within a context. And that context, the interests of that country, the interests of that beneficiary population should be paramount to the work that we are doing.
Nicolene's reflections on funding bring to light the often unspoken but critical aspect of what it means to truly collaborate in a meaningful and equitable way. It's not enough to recognise the value of local expertise. That recognition must translate into tangible support. The idea that international partnerships are not acts of charity, but rather mutually beneficial exchanges, is crucial. However, the imbalance often lies in the assumption that local organisations can stretch their limited resources to meet the demands of these projects without adequate compensation or infrastructure. Ultimately, by not trusting and respecting local leadership, we miss out on a better future for everyone, because we miss out on the effective interventions of local experts. Let's hear from Gunjan Veda, Executive Director of the Movement for Community-Led Development.
Growing up in India, right? I grew up in India and I spent practically all my life there till I moved out recently. It's amazing because on one hand, you see so much of deprivation. You see so much of poverty. You see so much of injustice. You see so much of discrimination. And yet at the same time, you just see the amazing spirit and resilience in the people. I remember seeing, you know, like in small village in Rajasthan in India, we went there and the school students, they had taken these, they would forage and find these used batteries. There was no electricity in their village after evenings. So ironically, when you need electricity, they didn't have electricity. They only got electricity for a few hours in the morning. And this was, of course, a few decades ago. So now things have changed. And what they did was they would forage for these batteries. They connected them and they created to a bulb and they had electricity in the evening. This is a group of 10, 12-year-old students who haven't studied any of this, but they just realized what they needed. They foraged for what was available. There was a town nearby. Batteries were just dumped all over the place. They would just collect them. And they found a solution. And to me, it's been remarkable. Every single place I have gone to, I have seen how people have been able to just use their own knowledge, their own creativity, wisdom from long ago to just make changes into not just their lives, but the lives of those around them. And I find it fascinating because on one hand, there is all these decades, right? We've been having millions and millions and millions of dollars, which have been spent on solving people's problems. And here are people who have no access to resources. They don't even have a dollar, forget millions of dollars. And yet they have managed to solve their problems. Why is it that we are not investing here in people? Why is it that we are still investing and creating a system that has not delivered?
Let's hear from Dr. Veronique Barbalet now for some insights into what this lack of trust looks like for those in the global north and how it hinders our work. Veronique is an independent humanitarian policy researcher and a research associate with the Overseas Development Institute's Humanitarian Policy Group.
Yeah, I think especially because of the work I do, so working on humanitarian policy research, I see a lot of that inequity and racism and neocolonial attitudes in knowledge production in the sector. And for me, that's been really difficult in the sense that I feel that as a white French woman who is associated with a very renowned Global North Research Institute, you know, I come into a country where probably I've never been to, And immediately I'm trusted. I know everything. I'm an expert. Like, that's the perception people have of me. And I had this really interesting experience where I was actually subcontracted by a Global South Research Institute, a national, you know, to do work within their own countries. And I really accepted the work because I thought it was really interesting. Like, oh, actually, that's interesting. I'm the one being subcontracted here, not the other way around. But it was a difficult experience, not because of my relationship with that institute. I have a great relationship with them. It was really hard because of the relationship we had with the donor. The donor still thought I was leading the work, not the director of that institute, who is much more senior than me. And then when we brought up issues around the fact that people we were interviewing on very sensitive topics were really pushing back on having to sign consent and on having to be recorded while interviewed. The donor said to us, oh, but Veronique, you have to understand, if it was you conducting the interviews, that wouldn't be a problem. But it's your colleagues of that nationality, the Global South colleagues that are conducting the research. So we need to make sure to record the interviews for quality control. And that's the kind of attitude that you will still see and experience in the work. And that, to me, is the ways in which you see neocolonialism and racism still being such a big part of that knowledge production in our sector. And how, again, as a person who probably has no contextual knowledge of that country, I'm immediately trusted, whereas my colleagues who come from this country are probably much better placed to conduct interviews than me because they speak the local language, they have the cultural understanding of how to approach people, especially on a sensitive topic. They're the ones who are distrusted. And I think that's really shocking that we're still in this day and age experiencing things like this. And I still believe I have a lot to contribute to knowledge production in the sector, but I don't believe that I can do it without that diversity, without that contextual understanding. And to still be faced with experiences like this, I find it quite shocking. And it means that we're still far in terms of that relationship between Global South and Global North and being and shifting power and shifting attitudes and changing attitudes, frankly.
Veronique has really demonstrated that connection between systemic racism and distrust. Levels of experience and seniority were irrelevant to that funder. Just because other researchers were from the Global South, they were not seen as trustworthy, and they were expected to put participants at risk by recording them and capturing their data just for the desires of this funder.
Uncomfortable about exposing our people just because we want to satisfy the exigencies of partners. That is not fair. It makes no sense.
Exactly. We talked before about how doing things differently, more equitably, with greater mutual respect, is more beneficial and transformative for everyone involved. So let's hear what this looks like in practice from Veronique.
For the longest time, Global South research collaborators were seen as just collecting, you know, there to collect the data. It's really, really critical to do analysis with collaborators from the context. I found that also to be quite really, really useful. And it's probably one of the best part of research, I find, when you sit down with the researchers and you're like, okay, we've been asking questions, we have all these data, now what does it mean? And to really work with people who know the context, who know, sometimes they know the history of the people you've interviewed as well. One of the greatest research experience I have was one doing some research on the livelihoods of Central African refugees in Eastern Cameroon. Mm-hmm. And to do this research, I actively sought to work with quite a diverse research team. So we had somebody who worked on education from a national NGO, Cameroonian NGO, somebody who had worked with an international NGO on livelihoods, but was also from Cameroon. We had a couple of people working with an ethnic minority interest organization that were the same ethnic group on both sides of the border between Cameroon and the Central African Republic, and then also a refugee from the Central African Republic who was a refugee in Cameroon. So it was a really diverse team, and it was wonderful to work with these people because of the way they all approached the issue of refugee livelihoods and the livelihoods of these Central African refugees in Cameroon. But what was interesting, and in my own biases, I had some ideas of which one of the researchers had more experience doing research, and so what kind of data or quality of data I was getting from each one of them. And you know, the data I used the most in the research in the end was from the Central African refugee. He had never done research before, but it's just his ability to understand and relate to the person being interviewed. We're doing life history interviews. So you really have to build a relationship with the person, and they're long interviews. They can last 2.5 hours, 3 hours. It was amazing the kind of evidence and data that he was able to get out. He didn't have any research experience, none, zero. And that shows you that how people you would think are maybe not fitting the criteria for a job, actually, because of their own experience, because of other skills they have, the cultural understanding, the ability to build rapport, their human skills, maybe not technical skill, but human skills, actually get you the best thing. So that's one of the experiences I had where, you know, within my own bias, I didn't think that would happen. And then I was really surprised. And that's when you get like that unconscious bias coming back to you and being like, oh, you see?
So how do we put these lessons into practice?
And I think generally on both sides, it is about that open communication. I would say that that's my first point and my first recommendation. And I'm sure that is nothing new, but creating safe space for dialogue where you can really talk to each other without fear. And I think that's how do you create that safety, that not fearing? Because obviously one of the biggest issue, and going back to the example I was mentioning when I was subcontracted by a Global South institution, one of the reasons why they were putting up with the kind of attitudes they were facing by the donor was because they really needed the contracts for their survival, and the fact that they still felt they had to play the old game to be able to continue having access to resources. So they took all the insults and the racism and the neo-colonial interactions and attitudes, because at the end of the day, that's what they needed to survive. So yeah, creating that safe space is so critical. And I think when I was thinking about, well, how do you create safety? And I think it's a little bit like when you think about inclusive management and inclusive leadership, it's about letting the other person that you value that what they say is actually critical and important, that you wouldn't be able to do your work without them, that their experience and their expertise is extremely valuable and important to you. And I think the more you do that, the more the safer the space becomes for them to feel like, well, actually, I do have an added value here. They do recognize this. So maybe I can say, well, when you did this, that didn't work for us because this is what it made us feel, or this is the consequences of that contractual aspect. The other one, which I mentioned, and I think it's less about how Global South Institutes change their mindsets, but about Global North Institutes, making sure that it's easier, I think, for Global South Institutes to collaborate with Global North Institutes if the Global North Institute is very clear about their added value and saying, we think the added value we have in this process or in this activity or in this program or in this research, is this something that would complement what skills and expertise and knowledge and networks you already have? Mm-hmm. If yes, should we work together? So I think by being really clear about, as a Global North actor, about what you think you bring to the table and recognizing that you don't bring anything, that you don't know everything, but that this is one thing that you can bring. And maybe this is something that the other side feels that actually that would be great if we work together. We could complement each other. And the other one for me in terms of really moving forward, and that's something that the Humanitarian Policy Group at ODIHR has been working on. And I think that's one of the biggest issue with knowledge production. Is who sets the agenda, the research agenda. And I think at the moment, at least my experience working for ODI is we're very powerful and we're very much able to set the research agenda, when actually maybe we're not the ones who understand what policy issues or practice issues that are critical to those living in context that are affected by the crisis that we're researching. And so one of the things that the Humanitarian Policy Group has been doing is working more strategically with a Global South Research Institute and come up with a research agenda that was based on the context, on a very specific context, and on what they saw as being the critical question to answer, and setting that agenda. And that's my last point, is then the idea is then the Humanitarian Policy Group is there to obviously contribute in its analytical skills and knowledge and expertise, but also to lend a platform of privilege and power and to be able to say, well, no, this is not just any Global South Institute that is maybe not going to be listened to. We're able to kind of extend our position of privilege and position of power and say, we support this, we're behind this, we work collaboratively on this. And then hopefully the more we do this and the more the Humanitarian Policy Research Agenda will be set, not in London, not in Geneva, but in the Central African Republic and in Congo and in South Sudan. And that, I think, for me will be very transformational and really great and inspirational and transform, like changing the sector.
As we wrap up this episode, it's clear that the themes of respect and trust, or the lack thereof, underpinned by white supremacy, are at the heart of many of the challenges faced by local experts in their partnerships with international organisations. The expertise and contextual knowledge of local actors are invaluable, yet too often disregarded. This disrespect is not just a matter of individual interactions, but it is deeply rooted in systemic racism and power imbalances that permeate the development and humanitarian sectors. We've heard about the tangible consequences of this lack of respect and trust, from rigid project designs that don't consider local realities, to the undermining of local experts' authority and safety. The call for mutual respect, flexibility, and genuine partnership is not new, but it remains as urgent as ever. As we move forward, it's essential that international organisations reflect on their practices and strive to build truly equitable partnerships. This means not just listening to local experts, but trusting them to lead, and recognising the power dynamics at play. Take a look at the show notes for today's action pack, which we hope will help you on your journey to decolonise. And look out for our next episode, where we'll take this conversation one step further, delving into the issue of inclusion of local experts and of those with minoritized identities. I hope you'll listen in. For now, it's been a pleasure to host you on The Problem with Partnerships. Take care.